Instagram is fantasyland. You see the highlight reels. It's the snippets of the best parts of your life and you don't see the rest. You don't see when the fences break. You don't see when your sheep run off a cliff. If it doesn't have that aesthetic and if it don't have all of the setups all at once, then I'm a failure. I think that's completely false. We always think that there's these transactions that have to happen. Oh, everything I need to source, I have to source with money. And it's not necessarily the case.
You don't have to have tons of money and capital or get a loan from a bank in order to purchase land in order to accomplish this. It just requires that you're resourceful. You're good at talking with people. You're good at forming local community.
The idea of doing everything on your own, it's such a trap. You called it a psyop, kind of is, because it makes you feel like you have to be isolated. You gotta do all of the things completely alone, especially as one single person. Get real. It's not gonna happen.
I'm stoked for this episode. One, because you're my personal assistant who I've gotten to know pretty well over the past. How long have you been with me? I actually have no idea.
I think almost 3 years. I think the spring will be 3 years.
That is wild. Like that's... If you had said like a year and a half, I would say that sounds right. But yeah, time is weird. One, that's one of the reasons. But then the other, I'll just briefly share my thoughts. So I think largely because of social media, a lot of us who have these dreams of off-grid, homesteading, self-sufficiency have had our, I don't know, like, mentality around it strongly influenced by what we see on social media. So we have these like grandiose ideas of how it should look because there's influencers who have hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars in capital who've created these homesteads and have created off-grid lifestyles. And there are some people out there who've been able to do it really from the ground up and get investments from other people. Find creative ways to purchase land. But all that to say, it can become pretty overwhelming where we sort of look at that lifestyle and ask ourselves, A, how can I accomplish this myself? And I know that you've sort of come to the perspective, and I agree with that, that self-sufficiency, like true self-sufficiency is a total psyop, and we can talk about that. But then the other thing is, it's like we look at these influencers who have these immaculate, grandiose, massive homestead operations. And we just imagine all the barriers to get to that. So we don't even try. We're like, there's just no way to get to that. And you've taken, I would guess, out of that false sort of approach, false dilemma, if you want to call it that, there's actually a separate way. You don't have to be all or nothing. It doesn't have to be like, oh, I can't get to that, so I'm just not going to do it. Here's some simple possible solutions that we can take. Options that we can take to sort of approach this and have a sort of in-between off-grid lifestyle. So I'm really stoked to talk about that. Before we begin, though, could you just introduce yourself?
Sure. Yeah. My name is Kimber. I live in Saskatchewan, Canada. Up in the sticks, we're right on the cusp of civilization, essentially. So where I'm living in the province directly south is basically all flat farmland. It's, if you know anything about Saskatchewan, that's like the quintessential vision that you see is like flat land. You can see your dog run away for 3 days is the joke. And to the north is thick boreal forest and it's wilderness. Like you go up north from where I live and you're in the bush. You can walk for days and not see a soul. So that's kind of where I live. And I am building a really basic homestead site. And so I've got big visions for it. I've got big ideas of what I want to do with it. But at the current moment, I'm just chipping away at it slowly with what I can with my means and my available time because I've got a little guy now. I've got a little baby now. So time's a little bit more constrained. And like you said, you don't have to necessarily go all in. There are ways to do it at tiptoeing your way in rather than jumping in the deep end, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And when you started this, I know you have a relationship now, but when you started this, correct me if I'm wrong, you were single. You were like just doing this yourself as a single woman, which I think is really cool to hear too, especially since my analytics, if they're correct, like 75% of the listeners of this podcast are women. But I just wanted to know if you have any commentary on what I said. Do you think social media has distorted what people think living off-grid has to look like?
Absolutely. Instagram is fantasyland. You see the highlight reels. We all know this, right? It's the snippets of the best parts of your life and you don't see the rest. So you don't see when the fences break. You don't see when your sheep run off a cliff. You don't see, you know, the chips in your wall that you're not videotaping. You only see the highlights. And I think that can be really misleading for people. thinking that like, oh, that's the way that homesteading or living rurally has to look like. It's that or nothing, right? If it doesn't have that aesthetic, and if it don't have all of the setups all at once, then I'm a failure. I'm not doing it right. And I think that's completely false. You have to start one step at a time with where you're at in your means currently, and just grow throughout time. And it's messy and it's ugly and it's not always Instagram worthy, the real homesteading.
Yeah. Before you lease the land, and we'll get to that, that you like didn't purchase it. So this is another option. Like, you don't have to have tons of money and capital or get a loan from a bank in order to purchase land in order to accomplish this. Before you lease the land, was there any like psychological barriers that you had to break through with respect to what we're talking about right now, with like what you see on Instagram, what you see from YouTubers with respect to homesteading or anything like that?
That is actually relevant to something that I had gone through in the past. Is I've been actually videotaping the progress the whole way with the intent of sharing it online. And it's certainly not picture perfect. It is the messy nitty gritty for sure. But there is a part of me that thought, oh my gosh, if I don't have the perfect content about it, or if it doesn't look a certain way, then nobody's going to want to see it and it's not worth it and I'm doing it wrong. I'm like, oh my gosh, that's not what this is about at all.
Well, I meant before you like, before even approaching getting the land to like do it, before you made the decision to get the land to actually start quasi homesteading, was there any barriers to like with respect to what you saw on social media regarding homesteading? Because you didn't grow up on a farm or anything like that, you know?
No, I didn't. I didn't grow up on a farm. We didn't grow up hunting or fishing either. So this is all new to me. In terms of like psychological barriers to get going, I don't know if I really experienced any because I was so set on wanting to do it. Like prior to this.
What made you want to do it in the first place?
I've always sort of felt a calling to the land. I really have. And always felt like, I mean, I get bored living in a small town. I've moved to the city multiple times for the excitement. And I always inevitably move back home to this rural area. Right now, my town that I live in is 300, 400 people. So it's pretty small. And then once the homestead is ready, that's the place where I'm going to end up living. But I'd always just sort of felt like an affinity and a calling to being in the woods, being in nature, learning about the plants around me. And so there wasn't a whole lot really in terms of psychological barrier. I just knew that I wanted to be out there and I knew that I would figure out a way to do it.
That's awesome. Okay, let's talk through that now. Like your process of acquiring the land and how you even went about that. Like what gave you the impetus to, okay, I know I don't have the funds right now to purchase land, which that's a lot of people right now. Like most people listening to this who want this off-grid lifestyle, who want self-sufficiency, which we'll get to in a minute in some way, see that barrier of purchasing land. So how did you go about the process of inquiring about leasing land instead?
Okay, so I want to give a little caveat because I don't want what I say next to discourage anybody from getting started. The land that I am setting up on, it belongs to someone in my family. And it's land that they're not using. And they had some people approach them to sell it multiple times. And they just said, I don't know, like maybe we should hang on to it. And I had approached and said, listen, I really love it out here. Would it be okay if I maybe like put a camper out there and lived out there in the summer? I just feel really good on that land. And that's kind of how the conversation started. And it turned into, we're not doing anything with it. You know, you can rent it and do whatever you want. And so we had several meetings outlining, okay, what is acceptable use of the land? Can I put a house? Can I have livestock? Can I put bees out there? Can I dig up the meadow to put a big garden? Like what? So we kind of had this negotiation process of what is it that is acceptable use of that land that fits into a rental agreement.
But the same will apply either way. Like even if this is one of your family members, like you go find, especially in North America specifically, where there is so much land and people are so spread out, especially you know, in at least the United States, which is what I can speak to, as you head west, there is so much land and you could easily approach someone who owns that land, a farmer or whatever it is, and say like, look, I noticed that this piece of your land is not being used. Could I lease it from you? And you could even discuss with them like anything that I grow on the land, if I intend to sell it or use it for any commercial purposes, I will negotiate a deal with you where you get some percentage of that. Something like that. Like you could still do this even if it's not one of your family members.
100%. And I've got two things I want to add to that just to kind of give people inspiration of how to even approach that. Because you might think, oh, I don't have family that. Yeah. There's excuses that we put in our own way. But there's two ways you can go about this that I would suggest. One is you've had Curtis Stone on the podcast before. What's his homestead systems business? What's the name of it? Where he helps people find farmland and homestead land.
I don't know that like that specific part of his business, but it's off-grid farming with Curtis Stone. I'm pretty sure is the name of the actual thing. Yeah.
So if somebody looks up Curtis Stone, he's got a software or a website that you can find land. So that's one method that you can do. And he's already pre-filtered that land based on his knowledge of homesteading, going, well, this one has poor water, or this one is the wrong elevation. Or so he's already done all that work for you to find land that is viable. Another way you can do it is if you're in, for example, there are RM maps. I don't know if the language is the same in the United States, but in Canada, we've got rural municipalities. So the RMs, and they're large sections of land. And there's always a RM town office, like an RM office, somebody that kind of like facilitates and coordinates the owners of all the land. And there are maps that are available. Now, you can have access to these maps. I don't know if they're available online, but if you go into the RM offices, you can talk to the administrator there and you can see exactly who owns which section of land.
We have the same thing in the US. I know there's actually apps for it, I'm pretty sure. Like my dad has showed me apps because he has property in Colorado and he shows exactly where his property lines is and then like either what trust or what individual owns the properties right next to him.
Exactly. So in that case, I would have a look. You'll see a lot of similar names where you're like, oh, this person, their name comes up 20 times. They're going to be the big time farmers, the big monocroppers. They're probably not going to have land for you because they're using it for income. But if you see a little home quarter, like a little 160 acres or maybe 80 acres where it's just one person's name on there, it doesn't hurt to approach that person because maybe it's someone who's wanting to shift their life and go to the city, or maybe it's somebody who's elderly and they're aging out and their kids don't want the land. There might be opportunities just honestly knocking on doors and shaking hands and saying, this is what I really, really want to do. I'm passionate about it. Is this available if I work with you?
I think a lot of people in this digital age have completely forgot about that approach with just life in general of just going to form relationships in person. And like, I don't know if it's a function of you living in rural Canada, because like rural Canada is even different than rural US in many respects because your population is so much smaller. So when you say you live out there, you like really live out there. I remember one time I made a joke with you about Amazon that actually turned out to be serious. I was like, I don't remember exactly what I said, but I'm like, it's not like we're waiting a week for Amazon. You're like, no, actually, if we order stuff on Amazon, it takes about a week to get to us or something like that. But we've just lost that in the digital age, like the ability to form relationships in person and talk with people in person and approach them in person in our local area. And I think like this would be so much easier had we not lost that, because you already know who owns the farm or the land 2 miles away from you automatically. Like it's already a given, but we don't know anymore. We barely know who's in our neighborhood if we live in a neighborhood. We barely know who's in our apartment complex if we live in an apartment complex.
Yeah. And I think, like you said, part of it is digital age where we all kind of hide it in our own little boxes with our little screens. And that's kind of our reality now. But I think, too, there is a difference between city living and rural living. And I do notice that talking to people who are raised in cities versus talking to people who are raised on dirt roads. Just completely different way of forming community, maintaining community, and just socializing even.
So I know a lot of people have talked about food sovereignty in a variety of ways in this space and how, whether it's chickens being culled in the hundreds of thousands, if not hundreds of millions, for nonsensical, quote unquote, viral outbreaks and things like this. There's a lot of concern surrounding food sovereignty right now. So how has this approach helped you to have more peace of mind with respect to food sovereignty? And then the second part to that question is, what has been the barrier to entry? Again, because you didn't grow up farming, you didn't grow up hunting or foraging or anything like this. So what has that process looked like with the land of cultivating gardens, putting in, really developing food sovereignty? And then how has that worked with the learning curve to start doing it?
Yeah. So this is actually kind of two topics at once. One is the self-sufficiency, what I call a myth. And then the other is the food sovereignty. And they're kind of two different things. So self-sufficiency, like we talked about earlier, was the idea of doing everything on your own it's such a trap. You called it a psyop, which I'd never really thought of it that way, but it kind of is, because it makes you feel like you have to be isolated. And that's not what this is about. You can't do cattle. You can't do foraging. You can't do sheep. You can't do bees. You can't do all of the things completely alone, especially as one single person. Get real. It's not going to happen. you have to learn to depend on your community. And so where I start with is, okay, what do I really want to do? I don't want to raise cattle. I don't. I want to be able to eat beef that does not have antibiotics or injections and has been grass fed or just raised ethically. That's what I want. I don't want to have to raise the cattle myself. So who do I form a relationship with, a business relationship with perhaps, where I can source that? And then on the flip side, what are the things that I really want to do and that I'm really capable of doing? And so planting a garden, I think, is the first easy place for everybody to start. Some people are like, oh, jump right into chickens or jump right into meat rabbits. It's like, grow your vegetables. See if you can hack that. Because there's so much nuance and such a learning curve if you've never done it before, that it's a great place to build confidence. And I've learned that you need less garden space than you think. So out on the land, so the trailer that I'm renovating is not ready to live in yet, but I had started on the garden because I was really excited about that part. And so I built this massive like 40 foot by 45 foot garden and filled it right up the first year, like planted all sorts. I couldn't process it all. I had to have help from friends to come help me harvest and process it all. And the amount of boxes that I gave away to friends and family, to like a food bank in the area, because there's absolutely no way I could have eaten it all throughout the year as a single person. And even now, like in a relationship and having a little baby and making food at home, we still couldn't have eaten it all. And so you need way less garden space than you think. And so that's another point that I wanted to bring up at some point in this conversation, is that you don't need 160 acres to do this.
If you frequently tune into the Way Forward podcast, don't skip this one. This is personal. If you've ever felt a shift from something that you've heard on this podcast, if it's helped you to see things more clearly, if it's helped you to break down a limiting belief system, if it's helped you just to generally question, or if it's helped you to feel less alone, then I'm asking you from my heart to help us keep going. We're not backed by corporate sponsors, venture capital money, or big donors, and that has been a deliberate choice. And we've said no to a lot of ad deals that weren't aligned because we don't want our mission to be shaped by products, brands, and agendas that we don't actually believe in. There are a few trusted brands and products that do support us, and we're incredibly grateful for that. But the reality is, this is primarily sustained by our listeners and viewers. Right now, this podcast has roughly 140,000 video and audio downloads a month, and it's continuing to grow. And only a small fraction of that actually help contribute financially. That's not a guilt trip, it's just the reality. We haven't said this directly enough, so here it is. If you'd like this podcast to continue, please help support us by becoming a member of thewayforward.com. If even a small fraction of listeners and viewers chose to support, we'd be able to easily sustain this. A membership at thewayforward.com is $99 annually, which amounts to about $8 a month. Think of it like a couple organic kombuchas at your local health food store, or maybe a fancy latte every month. And also think of it like this: in addition to ensuring that we can continue, you're actively supporting yourself in the process. Thewayforward.com is a private membership platform that allows you to instantly connect with aligned people, practitioners, farms, schools, restaurants, and more in your local area. And if the platform isn't for you, we've added a donation option as well. You'll find both of those in the show notes. If you've received something from the show, please consider giving back by becoming a member so we can continue to reach people, not just as a podcast, but as a movement for something good, true, and beautiful. Thank you so much for tuning in, and thank you for walking this path with us. This is a really good point, though. It's like 40 by 45 foot area was enough to sustain you and your small family really throughout the year, I'd imagine. And then like, I'd imagine you're also supplementing with like buying beef from local farmers and things like this too. But that's a really important point, that's enough to sustain you throughout the year. Did you have to go about like getting soil from elsewhere to bring it in, or is the soil on the land already pretty good?
In this case, it was somebody's home quarter. So it was never actually farmed. It was the quarter section of land where the house was of a previous farmer. And so it was an old beat up house that basically is going to be bulldozed and put into a pit at this point. It can't be salvaged. And then there's a lot of meadow. There's like, I think about 10 acres of meadow. And then the rest, the 150 acres is all woods, which is great for hunting because now we can just hunt straight out the back door. But the soil there was all just, it was all meadow, untouched. And so I had to pull up the prairie grasses. If you've ever seen like a diagram of prairie grass, how deep the roots go in to grab the water from below. So that all had to be tilled up. And it was a little bit sandy, if I recall correctly. And so I ended up speaking with a friend of mine. His dad is a cattle farmer. And so they've got manure that's been aging for like 10 years. And so he's got these massive piles. And I just said, hey, you know, can I come over and buy some manure off you? He's like, I'll just let you have it. And he helped me load it and everything. And so that's the power of community too, is like, you know, we always think that there's these transactions that have to happen. Like, oh, everything I need to source, I have to source with money. And it's not necessarily the case. It's like, okay, bring that person a garden box, or bring that person some baking, or sit with them for an afternoon and visit with them. Maybe that's all that somebody wants on trade for the excess that they have. And so that's the beauty of community. But yes, to go back to the soil, I did amend it with cow manure and then tilled it all up.
Okay. Did you rent a tiller or something like that?
A friend of mine is...
See, this is great. This is so rad. It's just like all friends in community.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, it's the friend whose father that I got the manure from. My friend Kirk is his name. And so he works for Brandt Tractors. And so he had a like a small little homestead tractor that he was trying to sell. And he's like, I'll do you a trade. I'll bring the little tractor. And if you can take some social media videos of us using the tractor, that's good enough for me. And it ended up not working out that way. The tractor wasn't accessible that day. He's like, it's fine. My dad has a tractor. So he pulled that over and he taught me how to drive it. And yeah, it was really wholesome and cute. So yeah.
That's awesome. That's awesome. So I don't know. Is there anything else you want to discuss related to food sovereignty specifically with this 40 by 45 foot area? Because again, like that's the thing that sticks out to me the most, is that we're all so, especially in the US, I'll say, especially near to cities, I guess, really anywhere, we're also concerned with food sovereignty. Understandably speaking, we see like a lot of issues with that, with these massive supply chains that we rely on. And I've often made it a message on the show, the importance of getting close with your local farmers and things like this. And that's why we have the Way Forward platform, where you can easily find farmers near you and things like this. But I just think that that is such an important piece, is that it doesn't require, like you said, 160 acres or anything like that. It just requires that you're resourceful, that you form relationships, you're good at talking with people, you're good at forming local community, and then you can grow enough to sustain you and your family throughout the year in 40, you know, in a 40 foot by 45 foot area. That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. But it does require a mindset shift as well and a break of your habits. So, I mean, currently you can zip to the grocery store and like I can get pineapples and avocados. I'm sorry, but those are not local to this area. Everything is imported and they're picked before they're ripe. And they ripen either through chemical processes or just over time through shipment. And so the food that you end up getting is nutritionally devoid as well. And so you might have it in your habit or in your routine that you're like, oh, I always have, you know, this type of food, and I always have my avocados, and I always have my coconut milk, and I always have, okay, that's great. But if you really want to have nutritionally dense, local available food that you've grown through your own labors, you're going to have to change your eating habits as well.
Yeah. And there's something to be said about growing, like eating from the land that you are standing on. I don't know how to put this. Like, I'd imagine that there is an electromagnetic imprint that we receive from the land that we are accustomed to living on. And that food is receiving that same electromagnetic imprint. It's like a terrain match when we're eating from the food that we're, you know, from the land that we're standing on, essentially. Like I noticed that, for example, when I go to Confluence and I'm eating food that is grown on Molly's farm, I can eat foods there that I typically avoid elsewhere because I notice digestive issues, my skin breaks out, et cetera, et cetera. But when I'm eating it from the land that I'm standing on and it's seasonally appropriate, I don't have any of those issues at all. I think that a lot of people in the health and freedom space severely underestimate the impact on our biology of eating stuff that is not seasonally appropriate, nor is it from the land that we are on, from the general area that we are living in.
Yeah, there's a couple things I want to add to that too. So I don't know if you know much about bees and honey. Have you heard that you should only eat honey from your local area? Okay, so there's reasons for that. There's also another thing I want to talk about too, is when you say that it's the food from your own land. Of course, there's a relationship between you and the plants. Of course. I mean, you look at, is it Veda Austin that does the work where she kind of piggybacked on Dr. Emoto? And I had learned about Dr. Emoto like 15 years ago, where he was talking to water and talking to plants, and it's affecting the way that the plants grow. So of course, when you're in the garden yourself and you're in a great mood and you're singing and you're hi little carrots. Like, I look like a crazy woman sometimes in the garden where it's like, thank you for growing. I can't wait to, you know, form a relationship with you. Thank you for joining my body. You know, when you have this kind of course it's going to change the way that it impacts your body. There's another thing too, and I haven't really experimented with it much, but I do find it a fascinating concept. You had Gabrielle on your podcast with Ringing Cedars of Russia. Okay, so in one of the Anastasia books, they talk about putting the seeds in your mouth before you plant them. Have you come across this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So this is probably on one of your former podcasts then.
Because you're getting the like the imprint of your body in the saliva going onto the seed. So the seed knows the exact nutrients that it needs relative to that plant, that fruit, that vegetable that's growing for you, for your body.
Yeah. So I keep all of that in mind when I'm growing the garden, and of course it makes a difference. And you eat garden food and gosh, it tastes so much better than anything you pick up at the store. Like it's a completely different experience.
So when it comes to the actual like gardening experience itself, this is another thing that comes up for people. It's like, how do I have the time in the day with all the other stuff that I'm doing? And this is why I like hearing from you on this, because I know that you're very scrappy and you are taking on multiple things at once in order to provide. And that's just like what's required of people sometimes. So I just like to hear from your perspective for the people who say, this sounds like way too much work for me, what that has looked like for you.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you're growing a massive market garden because you want to sell things, well, that's your job now. And it takes a lot of time and effort to maintain all of that. But if you're just growing a few planters or a small garden plot for yourself, even the one that I have, you go out there twice a day. So you pop out, you make sure the soil is good. You want to water, you know, not in the middle of the day because it's all going to evaporate or burn the leaves. So you pick your morning, your evening that you head out to check your weeds and make sure everything's watered. And it doesn't take that long. It really doesn't. The biggest job is harvest. The second biggest job is planting. Everything in between is just maintenance and visiting.
And what resources did you use in order to know what is seasonally appropriate where you live in rural Canada? And what resources did you find helpful for just the process of gardening itself?
Okay. The process of gardening, my grandmother, my dad's mother, always had a garden. And so before she, you know, was moved into a senior's home, she was a little bit more lucid in the past. And so I had the privilege of being able to ask her, like, well, why do you grow your asparagus over there? Or like, how did you get these grapes to grow? There shouldn't be grapes in our area. How do you get grapes every summer? And so asking her those questions when it came up, when I could, was really nice. But I never really did take like a proper crash course and like, this is how you plant. Most of it has just been trial and error, putting seeds in the ground and trying it and seeing what's happening and going, oh, carrots don't grow in the soil that's really hard because it needs to plummel through. And okay, so it needs to be a little bit more loamy and like, potatoes and blueberries, they like acidic soil. Okay, well, I learned that from a permaculture book that I found on a webinar one time.
Did you test the pH of your soil at all?
I haven't yet. No.
No, you just kind of deduced based on like what type of soil is here. This soil looks like it's probably more acidic.
Well, and testing it out too, and just growing things and going, okay, well, why did that grow really well, but this really didn't? And every year is going to be different too. So like, for example, not this past, so summer of 2024, cucumbers grew like crazy, like for everybody. Everybody had like way too many cucumbers. And then, you know, the next year you'll have your corn crop will be really poor. And they're like, oh, why are all my neighbors having poor corn crop? And so I find that there's some sort of rhythm in nature that I don't understand yet because I haven't been with that relationship long enough to be able to observe over time. But there are some seasons that are better for certain plants and worse for other plants. And it seems to be this breathing motion that I'm really fascinated to tap into.
That's cool. Wow.
Oh, another thing, when you're trying to figure out what it is that you can grow, you have to consult the zone that you're in. So for example, where I'm at, it's zone 3A. And so we only really get about 2.5 months of good summer. Outside of that, it's quite cold. So like our first frost date here is in September, the start of September, mid-September. So anything that you've grown above ground oftentimes has to either be covered or pulled out entirely because you'll lose the crop. And then our last frost is usually around Victoria Day weekend. It's May long weekend. So it's the end of May, start of June.
Gosh, that's crazy. That's so late.
Yeah, right. Like you don't want to plant anything above ground crops until that final frost point, because if you plant it, you can lose your whole garden kind of thing. So
but still in that short window of time that you have to actually you know, like garden, you still are producing enough to provide for you and your family.
Yeah, but it depends on what you want to grow too. So if you've got the right kind of plants that are going to be thriving during that short window, and there's a ton that do, it's not like we're scant and we only get carrots and potatoes. Like you can grow a massive variety of different plants. And if you start your seedlings indoors or in a greenhouse ahead of time, so that by the time June 1st hits, you've got a little seedling that's already this big, because you started it in March or April indoors.
Kylie and I tried that. And the thing that we failed on is we had 120 seedlings of a variety of fruits and vegetables. We did not properly weatherize them. Did you have to do that?
You do have to weather. Yeah, you got to get them like acclimatized.
Yeah, we did not do that at all. So we lost like all of them except for 20 or something like that. It was so bad.
Another thing I did one year is I planted some like too soon. And then they had like too much light and too much heat. And then they got really leggy.
Yeah.
But their roots didn't have enough space to really like to grow and fill the planter. So then I put them in the garden and they just, meh. So it's a lot of trial and error. You can't expect to have a perfect garden the first few seasons that you try it out. But that's the fun of it, right? That's the fun of it is building that relationship and learning and growing as you go.
Yeah.
Same thing with the homesteading, right? You start with the garden, then you're like, hey, I did a garden for a couple of years and that's been really fruitful. And I feel a lot of confidence about that. And I'm ready to branch out. Like, maybe I really want to have my own honey production. Okay, so maybe I'll have a couple bee boxes and I'll try that out for a season or two. And then, okay, I've really got the hang of that. And, well, what's it like to have chickens? Okay, let's try that. Or what's it like to have meat rabbits? Or like, maybe I really want to have sheep because there's milk, meat, wool, and fertilizer all in the same animal. But you're not going to go there on the first day walking in.
For generations, our ancestors lived in harmony with nature, thriving on a nose-to-tail approach to nourishment. Organ meats, often called nature's multivitamin, were a staple, providing essential nutrients that supported energy, brain function, skin, gut health, and reproductive vitality. Yet today, these deeply nourishing foods are largely missing from modern diets, leaving many of us unknowingly depleted. Let's be real though, most of us aren't eating organ meats the way our ancestors did. Whether it's the taste, texture, or simply a shift away from traditional foods, we've lost touch with this vital source of nourishment. And that's where Paleo Valley's grass-fed organ complex comes in. It's an easy way to reconnect with ancestral wisdom and replenish the nutrients we're meant to thrive on. Sourced from grass-fed cows on small regenerative farms in the U.S., this blend includes liver, heart, and kidney, freeze-dried to preserve their full nutritional integrity. No fillers, no synthetic processing, just pure bioavailable nourishment. Those who incorporate the grass-fed organ complex notice more energy, balanced moods, and renewed vitality, sometimes within days. If this speaks to you, you can explore more by visiting the show notes or heading to paleovalley.com/the way forward. And in this case, forward is fully spelled out. So paleovalley.com/the way forward. And a 15% discount will be automatically applied at checkout.
I think you have to like get comfortable with trusting the process and understanding that this is going to have to build over time. And that's totally okay.
Yeah. And that goes back to the conversation of like what you see on Instagram. You're like, well, they have the whole thing figured out. And like, they just started their account a year ago. And like, look, oh, they moved from the city. It's like, cool. They did that.
But also instant gratification too. It's like, well, fuck, like that seems like it takes a lot of work. So I just have this like natural resistance to it. You know?
Yeah. Well, so don't climb a mountain. Take one step up a small hill.
Yeah, that's it. One step. Another question related to like the food sovereignty piece. Have you had to learn how to can, how to ferment and things like this as well? Because I'd imagine that if you're growing a lot over this short window of time and you're trying to use it to sustain yourself really for the rest of the year until the next growing season, what practices and methods have you adopted related to that?
So interestingly, I started with processing food before I started growing food. My grandmother always did canning. She had shelves through her whole basement full of canned, like stuff that was like 15 years old. Like you don't eat it at that point. But she was kind of a hoarder with her canned food. And there's a bunch of stories I could share about that. It's really hilarious. But that's where I started. I'm just so familiar with seeing canned goods. I'm like, well, how do you do that? I want to learn how to do that. And I did it wrong because nobody ever taught me and I never really asked for help. Like I started, I lived in a camper one summer and I thought, oh, I've made this really great like curry and I want to be able to save some for later because I'm single and I made too much and I'm not going to put it in the freezer because my freezer is this big. Maybe I can can it. Well, you have to can it properly. And you have to, you know, if there's meat in it, you have to have a pressure canner and you can't just water bath can it. And I found out the hard way by having jars explode in my camper and rot. So again, there's a whole process of like, oh, just learning the hard way. So I started with water bath canning. I have not purchased a pressure canner yet because they're like $600 Canadian. And that's a whole other learning curve. So that's something I'd like to get into by next harvest. So this is how I process food. There's canning. So whether that's water bath or the pressurized canning, there's freezing, there's fermenting, and there's dehydrating. And so I started with all of those before I ever even really grew my own big garden. And I would just start with grocery produce. So this was during like the COVID years and I was unemployed for a little bit and like shopping from sale racks. And I'd buy a bag of apples that was 50% off because two of them were bruised. You know, I'm like, I don't care. So I'm like, well, what is it like if I make my own apple pie filling? Okay, I can can that. And then what if I dehydrate the slices of apples and I have that and I put it in my camping gear? So those are some different methods that you would do. And you kind of have to, when you have a big garden, you have to find different ways to keep your produce because you're going to get sick of eating the same thing. And you just don't have enough fridge space or enough time with that fridge space to keep everything usable.
I'd imagine you're getting really creative with your meals too, though.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Because you're not able to, like, I don't know, make chicken fajitas and stuff like that.
Well, I mean, that's the fun part is, so I've sort of started hoarding some things a little bit. And so my partner's like, man, I've never had this much food in my house in my life until you moved in. And it's like a big chest freezer full of stuff that we've prepared and like shelves of canning and like a pantry full of dehydrated stuff. He's like, Caleb, we got to use this stuff up now. We can't just keep making it. I'm like, okay, so what do we do with like this little shrapnel? Like there's this much, you know, dried like lemon balm or lemon thyme. What do I cook with lemon thyme? Okay, we get that and we got something in the freezer. Just throw stuff together. And so that's a ton of fun for me, but I love to experiment with food.
It's like art.
Yeah, it's a blast.
That's fun. That's so fun.
Yeah, total blast.
So another thing that stood out to me too is that, correct me if I'm wrong on this, you don't have water to the land yet.
Not yet. That's right.
Okay. No, I mean, that again, I'm just trying to check off all of the excuses people typically have to avoid doing something like this. And you have a lot of those excuses present and are still doing something like this. That's the whole point.
That's because I want to do it.
That's my point. Is like, a lot of people, their first thought, understandably though, with respect to water, is like, I don't have water hooked up to like my little plot of land. I need to install drip irrigation and that's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to like be massive towards my water bill. So what creative solutions have you adopted to be able to provide water to your garden?
So this past year that I grew out there, I had a water trailer, like a tank of water brought out on a trailer. I don't know the ramifications of that, like with BPAs and leaching from the sun. I'm like, it was one of those things where I was just like, la, 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 I need this garden to grow. I want to try it. Like, let's just do something. So there's like a water filling station in town where you just load up the water and that lasted all summer, honestly. So had a little spigot on it.
Was it attached to drip irrigation? Oh, were you actually like manually watering or did you do drip irrigation?
Manually watering.
Okay. Okay. But you could do drip irrigation with it though too, right? I'd imagine. Like,
I suppose. I mean, I don't know how effective it would be out there when the wind is blowing across the prairie. And because you're talking about drip irrigation, like through pipes or through like.
No. I'm talking about like on the ground. Like you see these like black tubes that are laid out right next to the plants with holes in them that will just naturally drip water to them as it's needed.
I think that needs a level of pressure though.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, I mean, theoretically, yeah, I guess if I, the tank of water is up higher than the ground and I had figured out the right pressure from the spigot, I suppose it could probably work, but I hadn't experimented with that at all. Because here's the other thing too, is like, you have to go out every couple of days. Like, ideally, you want to be able to touch your garden every single day. But at the time, that garden site, because the trailer isn't ready, I was living away. Like I had to drive 15, 20 minutes just to get out there. So I wasn't going every day. I'm like, well, that kind of gets expensive on gas and ripping out. And I've got other things I need to do. So I'd pop out every few days to pick the produce that was ready. Because if I didn't, I mean, you'd end up with pickling cucumbers that are supposed to be this big. Well, if you wait too long, now they're this big. And they're full of seeds and they just don't have the right texture and the right flavor. And it's not whatever. Long story short, I was not out there every day. And so when I did get out, I would just water by hand, weed by hand. and just work on it when I could. One more thing when it comes to the water too, is this is a system that I'll be setting up in the future once my trailer, the roof needs fixing, but I'm going to be installing eaves troughs with water collection barrels. So that's a thing that I'll be doing. Also, I've moved a little tiny shed that I found a shed. There was a renovation project. This is a community thing, back to this. There was a renovation project happening in town. Friend of the family sort of was demolitioning this whole place to build a new one. There was this old, like, just decrepit shed in the backyard that they put the lawnmower in. I said, what are you doing with that shed? And he goes, we're bulldozing it. It's going in a fire pit. We don't want that. I said, well, could I buy it off you? And he's like, you can just have it. If you move it off the land, get it out of our way, you can have it. So my dad and I figured out a way to get it onto a trailer without breaking it and moved that onto the land. That'll be like a chicken hut at some point. Not this year, but hopefully the year following. And so I can have rainwater collection off the chicken hut as well. And if it's not enough for the garden, at least it's enough for the chickens. So you find your little systems that kind of like feed each other, right? So I've got the tank of water there. I have got a quote for getting a well out there, but because of the elevation of the land, it's going to be very expensive. The well has to be very, very deep. I still need to do some more exploring on that. It is too deep down of a water table to do a sandpoint well. This well is probably going to have to be like 70 to 100 feet deep. So hence why I don't have water out there yet, because I'm doing this on a shoestring budget.
But you're still crushing it though. You're still providing enough for you and your family and then neighbors and other people just with what you're doing. Have you thought about any ways to turn the land into not only self-sufficiency in air quotes for you and your family, but also to be able to like make a profit off of it in any way?
Oh, you certainly can. A good piece of advice that I heard from multiple homesteaders actually was, focus on your family first. It's kind of like the oxygen mask. If you grow everything with the intent of providing and selling, you're not going to have enough left at home to feed your family throughout the winter. So focus on the systems that you need to have that are competent and producing well enough to take care of your own home. And then you sell off the excess. So that's a way to start. And then once you get really good at that, you go, well, yeah, maybe we want to branch out into doing more of a market garden. So we've got a secondary garden, and that's all for marketplace.
You know, the question that comes up for me is like when considering this, if you're listening or watching this right now, it's like, oh, man, this sounds like a lot of work. I could see that. And at the same time, it's like, how bad do you want it? How bad do you want to be sovereign and not have to rely on some of these systems that so many of us realize have become very problematic? Like, how bad do you actually want freedom? Those are the questions that come up for me. And like, each person has to answer that question for themselves. But it seems like to me, it's like all these barriers that were in place for you that a lot of people would have been like, all right, I'm just not going to do it. Sorry, this is too much. You just blew past them because it's like, no, I want it that badly. I want to be able to be disconnected from these systems a little bit more than I currently am right now. That badly. I want to not have to rely on going to the grocery store and spending tons of money on food. I want to be able to just provide. I want to be able to eat from the land. I want to cultivate a relationship with the land. I want this as a means to not force myself, but really encourage myself to get back into connecting with nature. It's like you have to wrestle with all those questions. How badly do you want it? Because so many people would have quit so much earlier with how many barriers you have.
But I think that's a good lesson all across any area of your life is, how bad do you want it? How much does it really mean to you? If you really, really want it, you'll find a way. If you don't really want it, you'll find an excuse. I think that's the quote. And so this isn't for everybody, and that's okay. Like, sorry, owning a yacht or like going water skiing every week, that's not for everybody either. But if you really, really want it, you're going to build your life in a way that aligns to that goal, and you're going to make it happen. Well, for me, that's, I want to be able to throw on my muck boots and go out in the woods and have a little walk out there and have my face feel cold and touch the trees and listen to the birds and make a relationship with all the herbs and the plants and the medicines that I find along the way. That's what I want to do. You know, I want to grow my own food. It's like, it's heartwarming for me. It's something that it's like, so when you talk about these barriers, it's like, yeah, and Like, it doesn't even register as a barrier.
It's also like a very rural Canadian mindset too, because it's like, yeah, we're kind of used to this, dude. It takes a week for us to get anything on Amazon. Like, going to the you and I have joked about this before too, where I'm going to the city, and like, what that means for me is I'm going to Austin that has 2.5 million people in the metro area. For you, it's like I'm going to a place that just has a big box store. That's like going to the city for you.
Yeah, I'm going to the city that has a Walmart.
Yeah, that's going to the city. That's so funny. What would you say has changed, like, in a positive way inside of you? Really think on this. Like, what has really changed for you internally after having done this?
What's changed internally after having done it? I'm not done. So I don't know that I can answer that question effectively. I don't know that I've come to the point of being changed by it yet. I'm still in the beginning stages of getting things going. I'm still fueled by like a hope and a dream. And so I haven't really reached that point of being like, oh, I'm transformed by this process, because I'm still in the thick of it. So I'm not really sure how to answer that in a way that is like, has a punchy line that'll really like hit people on the edge.
It doesn't need to. If that's the case, that's totally fine. But it's like, no, I'm still changing. I'm still in the process of changing throughout this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I think of like, I've got my little boy, and he's 7 months at the time of filming, and having him and going and birthing and raising him, like, that has transformed me already. And he's only 7 months. So that I can speak on, I'm like, oh, I know what that feels like to look at myself a year ago and to now and feel like so embodied in the change of who I've become as a result of that experience and that relationship. I don't quite have that same sense about the land, because I'm still in the incubation phase. I haven't birthed it. You know what I mean? I haven't fully birthed it yet.
Yeah. How has having a kid sort of changed things with your relationship to the land and like how much time you can spend on it?
Yeah, that's been tricky. So I ended up with an emergency C-section, which we've talked about. That's a whole thing. So that really threw a wrench into my ability to participate in the garden this year. So I was so, so heavily pregnant. I had so many people think that I was pregnant with twins. Like, I was massive. I could not get down to plant the seeds in the garden. Christopher had to do all of it, because I had no stamina. I helped the one day, and I think I helped with like a row of potatoes, and I'm just gassed. Like, I'm like breathing like a fat guy who climbed up a mountain, you know, like I'm struggling. So I wasn't there for most of the seeding. And then I had my C-section, and I couldn't even get out of bed to go to the bathroom by myself. So that was like a month and a half of being fully dependent on Christopher lifting me up so that I could go to the toilet. Like, so of course I wasn't in the garden then either. So there's all of that. And then having a newborn and also working remotely for you and doing some other things as well. It's just like, so it really changed my availability of time. And I think that's appropriate for this first year. It's a massive transformation. This is my first child, my first surgery, right? My first birth, first pregnancy, like all of the things were just like, so I was so enveloped in all of that newness and all of that transformation that I knew we wanted to grow a garden, but that wasn't my priority this past season, right? So the season that I talked about with the big, big garden out on the land, like that was two summers ago. So this past summer, 2025, we had a little plot that we shared with our garden, with our neighbors. And like I said, Christopher did most of that. And so I'm starting to get my energy back. I'm starting to engage, like Lucas is my baby boy. And he's really curious, and he's very smart, and he's really like aware. And he's always just, he's just wanting to check everything. He's so, so smart. And so I'm looking now of all the ways that I can educate him just to grow him developmentally, but also like, how can he be a part of our life? So, I mean, when he was brand new, I put his feet in the soil of the garden and we sat out there together, and I said, oh, these are carrots, like feel the carrots on your hands and, you know, like, you hear the wind. And so involving him in developmentally appropriate ways. And so I'm really eager for this next season, this 2026, where he's going to be walking, like he's crawling right now. He's going to be walking soon. Well, that's great. He can have his own little shovel. And while I'm out there planting rows, he's digging a hole and being destructive and doing what one-year-olds do.
Yeah, especially one-year-old boys.
Oh my gosh, he's bam, bam.
Most healthcare today operates on an outdated mechanistic model, treating the body like a battlefield rather than a self-healing system. You wait months for an appointment only to receive a rushed diagnosis that labels you rather than truly understanding your unique health. Even in holistic health, many practitioners rely on endless lab tests and supplement protocols addressing symptoms instead of the root cause. And the result? Another prescription or supplement regimen that merely suppresses or masks symptoms rather than facilitating true healing, whether the imbalance was physical, emotional, energetic, or a mix of all three. And that's why Dr. Tom Cowan co-founded the New Biology Clinic, to offer something radically different. As one of the most respected natural health doctors in the world, Dr. Cowan has spent decades challenging conventional medicine and advancing a deeper understanding of human biology, water, and natural health. His work isn't just about rejecting the mainstream. It's about offering a more truthful, biologically coherent approach for healing. The New Biology Clinic recognizes that health isn't about fighting disease, it's about restoring balance. You're not a diagnosis, you're an individual with a unique story, and healing should honor that. With virtual consultations available worldwide, the clinic offers a flat rate monthly membership that gives you direct access to practitioners who take the time to actually listen. Members also get exclusive health live streams, a resource library, and live sessions covering everything from biofield tuning and breathwork to movement and meditation, all designed to support whole body healing. And if you're not ready for a membership, you can book a one-time appointment, sign up for an enrichment-only membership for the healing modalities alone, or schedule a free connection session with one of the care team members to see how the New Biology Clinic can help in your specific situation. This isn't about keeping you dependent on doctors. It's about making you sovereign over your health. Head to newbiologyclinic.com and use code THEWAYFORWARD, and that's spelled the way, F-O-R-W-A-R-D, for $50 off account activation, or just head to the show notes for more info. If you're a member of The Way Forward, email hello@thewayforward.com for $150 off. Your body already knows how to heal. And New Biology Clinic helps you remember.
You know the Incredibles, Jack-Jack?
Yeah,
we call Shy Jack-Jack because he's...
Jack-Jack, Shy.
He's like just... He's so much. He's already in this phase where if he... if we're doing literally anything, he gets FOMO. Like if Charlie and Grace and my other two kids are playing with something and Kylie's holding him, or like he's in a walker, he has this like little walker because he's starting to walk almost now, he'll like shake his fists and get... angry because he's not able to do that. Or if Kylie's eating something and, you know, he sees that she's eating something, he'll freak out if he doesn't have any. So yeah, he's Jack-Jack.
Lucas is the same way too with the FOMO. Like I'll be breastfeeding him and he'll hear Andy noise and he's like, oh, what's that? You know, where I pick him up from his nap and he's like immediately orienting and he's just like, whoa, like eyes wide open. I got to check out every little thing. Like, and if I leave the room, he's not a clingy baby, like he's not a Velcro baby, but he just wants to be part of the action, right? So if I walk past him, he's like, hey, what are you doing? You know, so I'm like, okay, I'll pick you up. Let's go see the dog and let's go check this. So it's a lot of fun.
I've said that to you when I'm on the calls with you too, that when I hear Lucas in the background, I'm like, gosh, he sounds just like Shy. Like they sound identical. It's hilarious.
They've got similar sounds, don't they? Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to this upcoming summer of like just having more time and having more energy and in my body to be able to involve him and be a bigger part of the garden this year. So
yeah. So what I'm also getting at too, is like, you don't feel that having kids doing this is going to limit you in any way as well. You're still going to be able to accomplish all that you need to accomplish with the garden.
Call it homeschooling.
Yeah. I like that. That's awesome.
There's no gardening class in our schools here. Well, my kid's going to have gardening class. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. You think that that's more important than the quadratic formula?
Weird.
I think so. That's my point, is it's like we're not learning anything useful in public schools at all anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Thank you for the Pythagorean theorem, but like when have I ever used it?
Yeah, exactly.
Like I don't use algebra ever.
No.
And I get it. If you're like, oh, I'm going to go and, you know, go into some higher education and be so...
An engineer. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
An engineer of some kind, you know? But like how many of us really end up being lawyers or engineers? Like... most of us are working regular jobs and it's just like, I intend to homeschool Lucas. That's the intention is.
That's good.
Just seeing where the state of the Canadian public school system is at right now and talking to teachers who were teachers 10, 15, 20 years ago and are substituting now and going, oh my, these kids don't. My mom's a substitute teacher now and she used to teach in the high school years and years ago. And she said, I had a kid in grade 9 who couldn't tell me what a verb was.
Wow.
That's wild. And these kids are so like enveloped in their devices that they just, there's no social skills. Like I can name several children who are in their teenage years and there's just no social tact and no social.
Dude, I can name adults that are like that. Like what was going through my mind when you were saying I formed this relationship with this farmer. I talked to him about that. He said, get the shed off and blah, 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 blah. The whole time in my mind, I'm thinking like how many people I know who the primary barrier is they don't even know how to interact with other human beings anymore because they're so obsessed with the digital space.
Well, it's skills. It's a skill building. If you don't ever build that skill, you don't have it. You don't come out of the womb knowing how to, you know, be social and charismatic. That's something that you learn. You don't know how to be a good listener unless you practice being a good listener.
I just think it's like, well, people, I don't know. It's like people seem to have had it previously and we are slowly losing it because of how much we're indoctrinated to look to this for community, right? Especially people in the health, truth, freedom, consciousness space where we feel invalidated by the people that are on the ground near us in many ways, you know, because of what's gone on over the past 5 to 6 years. So we do sometimes turn to this as our primary means of feeling a sense of quote unquote community. And I think that's a psyop too. It's like on one hand, again, we have our platform, which helps you find like-minded people near you. And I'm like thoroughly convinced that there are far more people in our areas that are like us than we realize. There's just no way to connect with them. But then the other side of that, like the idea that we need to only form community, that we can only engage with people who didn't get vaccinated. Like that's a psyop too. That's not how the world works. But social media is conditioning us to believe that. And like, yes, I understand that we feel hurt, that we feel disrespected, that we feel invalidated, we feel ostracized by the people who are super pro-vax or like super pro-COVID narrative, super pro-climate narrative, super woke agenda. Fine, like that can be true, but social media is conditioning us to believe that like we shouldn't even interact with them. I don't believe that at all. Like I do not believe that.
Yeah. And is that because we're being conditioned by some power that be, or is it just that it's easier to be ballsy and rude when you don't have to look at someone's eyes?
Combination of both, I'd say. Like I'd say it's that like the powers that be, so to speak, like realize that and can use it to their agenda of divide and conquer, because then we're just constantly at each other's throats, not understanding like, oh, what is it with these systems that has us constantly looking at each other as enemies instead of understanding that it's an intentional tactic because they can, you know, issue new policies while we're distracted with this, et cetera, while also failing to realize that on the other end of that screen is a real human being with a complex story, complex life experiences, having their own algorithm that is conditioning them to believe certain things in a more extreme way relative to what we believe in. We fail to see that. So I think it's a combination of both, but you know, I'm open to being wrong on that.
Well, and you can't really heal that unless you are face to face with people. And I've got an example of that, if you don't mind. So I've had this neighbor. So during the COVID years, I was actually living on the other side of Canada. I was in the East Coast. I was living in Halifax area. Okay, so during the COVID years, I was living across Canada. So I was living in the East Coast, Halifax area. And so I experienced all the shutdowns and all of the negativity while I was out there. Long story short, I hadn't experienced negativity from people that I knew back home because I wasn't surrounded by them. So I associated all the negative feelings with people that were out in the Halifax area. And so when I came back home to my little town, I knew that there was polarizing ideas because of conversations I'd had with other people who thought like me or felt like me. But I didn't have those like emotional imprints of being like, oh, that person who used to babysit me is now unsafe. Or like that person over there was talking about throwing people like me into detention camps. Like I just didn't have that psychological like trauma associated with people that I had known previously. When I moved back home, I met up with one of my old neighbors. Lovely lady, but very different in her worldview and her beliefs about a lot of things. And so we had met up and had coffee and caught up. And she's like, oh, I sure missed living next to you. And how you been? And how are things going? And she made a comment about, well, and all these redneck anti-vaxxers. And I let her go off. I thought, okay, get it out, get it out. And I said, you know, that's me. And it made her stop. And she's like, well, but you're not like that. I said, no, but those, I made the same decisions. That's me that you're talking about. And like, and I think it kind of shifted something in her head where she's like, well, she's not a bad person. Like, she's really lovely and we've always gotten along and she's responsible. She's respectful and she's kind. And then, you know what? She came to my baby shower and we see each other around town. We exchange Christmas cards. And had I not taken the time to maybe sort of heal those painful relationships out west through or out east through people that I had known back home, I mean, I'd probably still be stuck in that state of like, oh, I can only socialize with people who see things the way that I see things. And then you're kind of stuck. You're pigeonholing yourself. It's like, well, there's so much more beauty in community when we allow each other to be who we are and be accepting that we don't see things the same way and we don't make the same decisions. And that's great. That's what weaves this whole tapestry of community. And we need each other. And we miss that on social media when it's all polarized, right?
Yeah. And like, you miss it to the degree that the slippery slope of cancel culture of like polarizing yourself or in sort of ostracize, like self-ostracizing from anyone that is not thinking the same way as you, as it leads to, like, I just had this example the other day where, you know, I'm outspoken online and I have a lot of followers, whatever. So this happens quite a bit, but this one was like pretty interesting where this lady who had followed me for a long time was super supportive of, agreed with basically every take that I've had. And I could see the comment thread. She had sent me a lot of messages. I don't really check them like all that often, but she was constantly commenting on how she agreed with what I was saying. I had one take and I said, in my opinion, this related to something that happened recently. And I posted that just one time on Twitter and I wasn't even inflammatory. I was just like, and I'm open to being wrong. And then she screenshotted that and said, this is discrediting you, immediate unfollow. And she unfollowed me. And I'm just like, what is this phenomenon where you have to agree on every single thing with someone? Otherwise you're going to cancel them. Otherwise you're not talking to them anymore. It's not real. It's like, that's not practical. It's not how human interaction works when it's face to face. No one actually does that. It's just a product of, or I guess you could say inflamed by, exacerbated by the digital age where like we are almost like self-polarizing into these very, very, very tiny groups. And okay, like maybe you want your very, very close friends. Maybe I could see an argument where you want your close friends, like the people you're closest to be aligned on most of those things. But to think that like, I can't even communicate with someone, I'm unfollowing someone if they have one thing that they disagree with me on, that's insane to me.
It's childish.
It's childish.
It's immature and it's dismissing the nuance of human nature. Like, sorry, we're all complex and we're not all completely aligned. It's like, you can't. Are you looking for a clone of yourself? Like, are you just trying to live in your own little echo chamber and you only like people who think exactly like you and do exactly like you? How boring is that? I'm sorry, I don't want that. That's not what I want.
Agree. Totally agree. Okay. Is there anything else you want to share about the land? Anything top of mind?
Gosh. It's a work in progress. I'm so excited to keep it going. And I thought for a short time that like maybe I'm comfortable because right now I'm living with Christopher in a house that he had bought and it's comfortable. It's a 3-bedroom, 2-car garage. Like it's a home and we've got a nursery for the baby and like we've got furniture and my intention was to live in this tin can beat up trailer with a wood stove and no couch and just me and my pets. And I was like gung ho about that. Right. Like I'm really excited. But now that I've moved into like a bungalow, I'm like, oh, like maybe. I don't know, like maybe that dream's over. Like maybe it's just better now that I have a child that we just stay in a comfortable home. We don't have to worry about mice in the trailer or like smoke from the wood stove affecting his lungs. Or like you start questioning these things, especially I think as a new parent. But I know myself and I know that if I allow myself to stay comfortable, I won't grow. And I won't push past things and I won't learn new skills. And like, to me, that's more valuable than being like comfortable and warm. It's like, let's have some cold nights. Let's have wet socks. Let's have chickens that get sick with Merrick's disease and you got to put them down. And I want to experience all these things. It's just like so much more of a rich experience that I think you know, you miss out on a lot of richness in your life when you stay in a comfort zone and you want things to be just so. It's like, sometimes I kind of just want to like create a little bit of chaos, like positive chaos in my life, just for the fact that it gives everything more flavor. And so I'm very, very eager to keep this project going, get this trailer livable, whether it turns into a weekend home or a summer home or who knows, it's going to grow as we grow. Where am I trying to go with this? I guess just the project is still underway and I've been videotaping it the whole time. So I've been collecting video footage for the last couple of years and I intend to put together a YouTube channel. So I do have a YouTube channel. Probably by the time this airs, I should have one or two videos out. And so that's kind of a fun place where I'll be able to sort of catalog the growth of the land. You can see it right from just raw land where it's just prairie grasses. Oh, suddenly we've done all the work. Here's all the work that we put into the garden. Here's what it's produced. Here's the trailer. Here's the day I moved it onto the land. Here's what it looked like before. Here's what the demolition is looking like. Like all of the process of growing through all of it. I've been documenting and cataloging all of that. And so I really hope that that'll serve as inspiration for other people that can come and watch it. And
I think it will. I really do think it will, because it's again an example of, I'm going to use your words, being able to homestead and create some independence and freedom and extract yourself from the clutches of any of these systems on a shoestring budget, which is like what most people are on. And that is typically the biggest barrier for people. And you're a mom. And when you started this, you were single, you were doing it like, I won't say by yourself, you had community help, but you were orchestrating all of it by yourself. And you don't have water on the property, like all the things, all the barriers that we talked about, like, okay, here's how you can still accomplish this and grow enough food to provide for you and your family and then some.
Yeah,
with all those barriers.
And see a lot of the shortcuts that I took too and go, well, I didn't have this tool. Maybe we do it this way. Or, you know, didn't have this piece of equipment. Maybe we do it this way. And so just showing that like the biggest key to it is having the heart for it, the drive for the project, and being really resourceful and calling upon your community. I think those are the biggest takeaways that I would give to people who are wanting to create some food sovereignty for themselves or to grow or to move more rurally or live in a way that's more connected to the land. Those are the big key takeaways that I would give to folks. And I hope that my YouTube channel that's being built right now will be able to serve some inspiration for that. So people can see, oh, I don't have to know it all right off the bat. Oh, I don't have to be super wealthy to do this off the bat. Like you can do this piece by piece and it's more accessible than you think.
Amen. Amen. Well said. Thank you so much for joining me, Kimber. I'll talk to you again later today and then tomorrow.
And then the next day and the next day.
I appreciate you so much. Thank you so much for joining me on this.
Thanks, Alec.